from the first chapter and then jump into a slightly later chapter. So what I'll tell you is that so far in the book, at this early point, we've been following a guy named Danny as he tries to get into a castle. And then at a certain point, the narrator announces himself as an actual person. And this is the point at which we jump in. The two things I'll mention is one is the narrator is male, just so you know that up front, and you're not confused by the fact that I'm not. And two, there's a lot of profanity in here. Sometimes people don't like it. Sometimes I don't like it. But there you have it, so you stand warned. I started the class with a bad attitude. For the second meeting, I wrote a story about a guy who fucks his writing teacher in a broom closet until the door flies open and all the brooms and mops and buckets come crashing out and their bare asses are shining in the light and they both get busted. It got a lot of laughs while I was reading it, but when I stopped reading, the room went quiet. Okay, Holly says, reactions? No one has a reaction. Come on, folks, our job is to help Ray do the very best work he can do. Something tells me this may not be it. More quiet. Finally, I say, it was just a joke. No one's laughing, she says. They were, I say, they laughed. Is that what you are, Ray, a joke? I think, what the fuck? She's looking at me, but I can't make myself look back. She says, I bet there are people out there who'd tell me yes, Ray is a joke, who'd tell me you're trash, am I right? Now there's muttering, ow, and shit, and what about that, Ray man? And I know they expect me to be pissed, and I know I'm supposed to be pissed, and I am pissed, but not just that, something else. There's the door, she tells me, and points. Why don't you just walk out? I don't move. I can walk out the door, but then I'd have to stand in the hall and wait. What about that gate? She's pointing out the window now. The gate is lit up at night, razor wire coiled along the top, the tower with a sharpshooter in it. Or what about your cell doors, she asks, or block gates, or shower doors, or the mess hall doors, or the doors to the visitor entrance? How often do you gentlemen touch a doorknob? That's what I'm asking. I knew the minute I saw Holly that she'd never taught in a prison before. It wasn't her looks. She's not a kid, and you can see she hasn't had it easy. But people who teach in prisons have a hard layer around them that's missing on Holly. I can hear how nervous she is, like she planned every word of that speech about the doors. But the crazy thing is, she's right. The last time I got out, I'd stand in front of doors and wait for them to open up. You forget what it's like to do it yourself. She says, my job is to show you a door you can open. And she taps the top of her head. It leads wherever you want to go, wherever you want it to go, she says. That's what I'm here to do, and if that doesn't interest you, then please spare us all, because this grant only funds 10 students, and we only meet once a week, and I'm not going to waste everyone's time on bullshit power struggles. She comes right to my desk and looks down. I look back up. I want to say, I've heard some cheesy motivational speeches in my time, but that one's a doozy. A door in our heads? Come on. But while she was talking, I felt something pop in my chest. You can wait outside, she says. It's only 10 more minutes. I think I'll stay. We look at each other. Good, she says. So I'm jumping a little ahead now to a meeting of the class at a later point. What I want to know, Tom says, after I read out my stuff in class, is which one of these clowns is you? Clowns? I squint up my eyes at him. Clowns are a touchy subject with Tom. I'm surprised he brought it up. Okay, he says, assholes. Easy there, Holly says. Not because of assholes, that's almost polite, but because he's saying it about something I wrote. And on Holly's list of rules, respect for another's work is ahead of no physical contact. One more way you can tell she's never taught in a prison before. Tom's a guy nobody likes, but that doesn't tell you anything. Tom's a guy who likes the fact that nobody likes him because it means he must be right about the world being one enormous piece of shit. I guess you could say Tom likes being right more than he likes being liked. I already knew who he was because of the geckos. We have a reptile program where inmates keep eggs under lights and then raise the baby lizards or what have you until they're big enough to be sold in a pet store. Tom's our gecko man. They're medium-sized, the brightest green you ever saw. He takes them outside on leashes made out of string and lets them run around in the dirt. He rubs their shiny little heads and kisses their lizardy lips. Maybe a year ago, a horror show named Quince walked up to where Tom-Tom's geckos were playing in the yard and put his boot through one of their heads, just crushed it cold. That was back in the days when all I did was sit. Depression, laziness, despondency, being a goddamn snitch spy. Why I did all that sitting, dependent on who you asked. That day, I was on a bench maybe 20 yards away from Tom-Tom across a chain-link fence. He should have been on his knees thanking God it was only a gecko Quince decided to smash that day. But as soon as Quince was gone, Tom-Tom's face did something I've never exactly seen before. It crumpled and collapsed like there was a boot on his head crushing it, and his lips drew back so his mouth was a black open hole, but no sound came out. At first, I thought he was having a stroke or a heart attack, and then I realized I was seeing pure misery, the kind people only show when they think they're by themselves. Then Tom-Tom saw me through the fence. For a split second, I thought, I'm dead. And I would be dead, no questions asked, if he was a real con. But Tom-Tom's not a con. He's a meth freak who loves reptiles and hates everything else. Who says any of these assholes is me? I asked Tom-Tom now. Well, you sure as shit didn't make it all up. I did make it up, I say, because I want Holly to think that. Otherwise, it's all just stuff a guy told me, so why not be impressed with that guy instead of me? No one could make this shit up, Tom-Tom says. It's too ridiculous. More ridiculous than walking into a bank in a clown suit and shooting three people? Ham Sam says, and the room gets snickery. It's funny with Ham Sam and me. We're friends, but we almost never speak. Maybe that's why we're friends. Fuck you, shitbag, Tom-Tom says, but his ears get pink. I write down, shitbag. Hey, Holly warns Ham Sam in a sharp voice, our crimes stay out. Remember that? But she's looking at Tom-Tom and you can tell she's thinking, clown suit? Alleged crimes, says Alan Beard, our resident brain. Our crimes? Tom-Tom's smiling up at Holly and his smile is like a lizard's smile. Is that what you said, our crimes? Only to be nice, Holly says. I have to admit, she's learning fast. I've tried everything to get her to look at me, clamming up, asking questions, laughing, stretching, knuckle cracking. Every week I bring in something to read, and after I read it out, she glances my way because she has to, but her eyes don't connect. They're looking next to me or behind me or even through me. I guess the stuff I wrote about the guy fucking his writing teacher made her nervous. And I feel like telling her, babe, that wasn't you, okay? That writing teacher was an actual blonde. Not to mention she was under 30, no wrinkles around her eyes, and she had curves on her like you wouldn't have if you ate Snickers bars around the clock. Plus she wore dresses. Ever heard of those? And she smelled like strawberries, or mangoes, or licorice. Hell, I don't know. But being inside changes everything. Stuff you'd call common or even flat out invisible in the outside world turns precious in here with magic uses you never thought of. A broken pen is a tattoo gun. A plastic comb is a shank, meaning a knife. A couple of plums and a piece of bread are next week's hooch. A packet of Kool-Aid is dye, an air shaft is a telephone. Two paper clips in a light socket plus a piece of pencil lead will light up your cigarette. And a gal like Holly, who maybe you wouldn't raise your head to look at out in the world, in here, she's a princess. I don't think you're nice, Tom-Tom tells her. I think you're guilty, just like the rest of us. Speak for yourself, Ham Sam says, and a few guys bang their desks in agreement. Holly smiles at Tom-Tom. She has pale eyebrows, bloodshot eyes. Her nose is long and kind of pointy. She has nice lips, I'll give her that. They're pink and have a clear, soft shape, even without lipstick, which she never wears. No makeup of any kind. I'm watching her carefully, which is something you can do with a person who never looks back. And when Tom-Tom tells her she's guilty, a kind of ripple happens in Holly's face. And through the ripple, I catch something I haven't noticed before, but I realize now it's been there all along, all the time, right from day one, pain. Tell us about your crimes, Holly T. Farrell. Tom-Tom says. She's still smiling. None of your fucking business, Tom, she says. That's one day. They run together. All you want is for the weeks and months and years to pass so your time inside can be over like a bad dream and you can get back to your real life. But the longer you're inside, the more your old life is what starts to feel like the dream. And of course, I want it back, but the problem is, when do you have the same dream twice? Nothing changes in here. 425 steps to my maintenance job, always walking on the right side of the yellow line that runs down the middle of every corridor. 320 from there to Chow, 132 from Chow to D block. Lights out at 11, on again at 5 for the first count. Four more counts with a standing count at 4 p.m. in our cells. Three stints a week in the weight cage, four packages a year. But for me, it's usually less because the only family I've got is distant, so my packages are always things I order for myself. My cell, 6 feet by 10, two metal trays nailed to the wall with mattresses on top that look like old taped up cushions from patio chairs. No one ever wants the top bunk. People cut each other over bottom bunks, but I like the top because it gives me the best view of our window, 5 inches wide, 24 high. It has some kind of special glass that smears up what's outside into murky gray shapes, maybe to keep us from masterminding our grand escape, or maybe because a window you can actually see through would just be too nice. But get this. After that second class with Holly, when the door in my head opened up, I sat down on my bunk and looked at the window, and all of a sudden, I could see through it, straight to the yard. Concrete, fences, guys sucking in fresh air. I practically yelled, but I stopped myself because sudden movements or noises are not a good idea around my celly, Davis. Nowadays, I can stay on my tray for hours looking down at those figures moving around in the gray. I watch them like I never could if they knew I was there, and I notice stuff. How Alan Beard pulls out the hair in his beard. How Ham Sam walks like a chimp. How Cherry turns to the fence and cries when no one's watching. How Tom Tom lets the geckos sit behind his ears and climb up his ponytail. It's better than television. "The hell are you looking at all the time?" Davis asks me. "Nothing." "Then why are you looking?" "Why do you care what I do?" "I don't give one blessed goddamn what you do." "Good." And I go on looking, and Davis goes on hovering, which in a space this size means taking a step toward the window and then a step away from the window and staring at me. Davis is a porter, so he's always around. He sweeps, he mops the tier halls, and in return, the COs never flip our cell, and Davis can stockpile shit underneath his bunk, a space that's officially one half mine. God knows what he's got under there, shanks, contraband, a bomb for all I know. He tucks a red and white checked tablecloth under his mattress so it hangs down to the floor and covers up whatever's under there. I've never lifted up the tablecloth. Davis gets rabid if I go near it, but I'm curious. "I have certain reasons for asking," he says. "Asking what? What you're looking at." "And what reasons are those? You answer my question, I'll answer yours." "My answer is nothing. I'm looking at nothing." "Bullshit. No one looks at nothing." "No, you don't look at nothing, Davis, but I do look at nothing." "Well, that's a poor use of your time." As far as Davis is concerned, all I do in here is waste valuable time. His whole day is organized down to the minute. Hell, for all I know, he budgeted an extra 5 to hassle me about the window. When they first put us together, he gave me lectures on self-improvement, on building and achieving, and dragging myself out of the muck, that kind of thing. And then at some point he decided it was hopeless. But here's the funny part. I signed up for Holly's class to get away from Davis one night a week. And since I started that class, everything feels different, brighter, sharper, a little strange, like I'm starting to get sick. Davis has a project of his own that drives me pretty nuts, although I try not to give him the satisfaction. He does a daily minimum of 700 push-ups in our cell. I have nothing against personal fitness, but come on, 700? We're talking a level of grunting and sweating and groaning and by the last 100, screaming out for mercy that would be hard to take even in a giant space such as a gym. And this little trap, it's a horror show. And I don't even mean the cat calls from everyone else on the tier about what I'm doing to Davis to make him howl like that. I mean the sheer racket of it. But around the same time that our window glass got straightened out, Davis's workout started hitting me a different way. It happened when I listened to his words. The more shaky and worn out Davis gets from his push-ups, the more the normal words we all say every day start getting mixed up with old words he must have used at some earlier point in his life, goon and dildo and asswipe and your mama, words left over from a life that's long gone. And once I noticed the old words Davis uses, I started hearing them everywhere, because this place is a word pit. Words get stuck in here, caught from when the clock stopped on our old lives. So now when a fight starts up, I don't walk away like I used to. I crowd in and wait for those ghost words to start coming up. I've heard chump and howler and groovy. I've heard fuzz and kike and kraut and coon and square and roughhouse and lightweight and freak show and mama's boy and cancer stick and fairy and party hardy and fly boy and knuckle sandwich. Don't forget we've got lifers in here with false hips and false teeth who can tell you tales about rolling bums on the Bowery if you get them going. And I grab up these expressions, I trap them in my head and I save them, because everyone has the DNA of a whole life in it, a life where those words fit in and made sense because everyone else was saying them too. I save up those words and later on I open up the notebook where I'm keeping the journal Holly told us all to keep, and I write them down one by one. And for some reason, that puts me in a good mood, like money in the bank. In the next class, I read again, and Mel speaks up first, which is surprising because Mel hardly ever talks. Ham Sam isn't there. "I've got a reaction," Mel says. "Actually, it's a problem, Miss Holly." "Shoot," Holly says. Mel clears out his throat and says, kind of formally, "I would like to know what's going to happen next." Holly waits. She's expecting more, and when nothing else comes out of Mel, and she realizes this is the problem he's talking about, she smiles. "Mel," she says, "that's a good thing. It means the story has engaged you." "No," Mel says, "it's not a good thing." He has a soft, panting voice, a high blood pressure voice that goes along with his body, which looks fatter every week. How he does it on the shit they serve in here, I don't know. He says, "It's not a good thing because it makes me uncomfortable." You don't want to make Mel uncomfortable. He's big and dumb and dangerous. The word is he tried to kill his wife by grinding up 300 vitamin C tablets and sprinkling the powder on her clothes and her pillow because someone told him vitamin C was toxic if you inhaled it. "Define uncomfortable, Mel," Holly says. "I mean, like, I get an uncomfortable feeling inside me that's like an empty feeling. It's a disappointed feeling. Like, I want to know what's going to happen, and I feel bad not knowing. Like, Ray's holding out on me. And then I start to have a pissed off feeling. Pardon my French, Miss Holly." "It sounds like you're describing anticipation," Holly says. "And that's not a problem, Mel. That's what a writer lives and hopes for." "It's a problem because being uncomfortable is not what I like," Mel says. The quieter he gets, the more he means it. "Tell me what happens, Ray." "Mel," Holly says, and she laughs like she doesn't believe it. "You can't make that demand. It's not fair." "I say it's not fair of Ray to make me wait." Tom Tom's sitting next to me. He picks that desk every week. Who the hell knows why? Now he's twisting and flicking around, and finally he turns to me and says, "Come on, Ray, tell us what happens. You were there, right?" I look at him and smile. I don't know why I like pissing Tom Tom off, maybe because it's so easy. "See, Ray won't tell," Tom Tom says. "He'd rather sit there with a shit-eating grin all over his face." "Pardon his French," Cherry says, and he and Alan Beard start to laugh. I write in my notebook, "shit-eating grin." Mel waves away the laughs. "You've got no reason not to tell me what happens, Ray," he says, and his voice is butter melting in a pan. "The way I feel right now," he says, "I'll be personally offended if you don't." I have no interest in personally offending Mel. He was in the hole for 3 months after he stabbed a guy named Julian Sanchez with a toothbrush he'd made into a shank by scraping it over the pavement. Luckily for Sanchez, in the heat of the moment, Mel accidentally used the brush end. But when I start talking, it's not to make Mel happy. I do it for Holly, to get her to look at me. Being inside turns us back into infants. Guys kill each other every week over, guys kill each other over a volleyball call. They throw their food and piss and shit because what else is there? What else have we got? And I need Holly's attention. That's all. I need it. "Well," I say, "the next thing is that Danny's going to set up that satellite dish he's brought and call his ex, Martha Mueller." "Okay," Mel says, "and say what?" "You don't have to do this, Ray," Holly says, eyes to my left. "The main thing is," I tell Mel, "Danny wants to get back together with Martha, but she won't. I need the words, Mel says. Right now you're just making noise in my ear. Holly's waiting, but she's not happy. Okay, I say to Mel, here are some words. Hey, Martha, it's Danny. Yeah, I made it okay, and I'm here in this old castle with my cousin and some other people, and I'm thinking about you. I get a heat reaction in my face, but I keep on going. I was wishing we could. I was hoping we could. Now I'm stumbling, hardly getting the words out, and the guys are laughing like mad. Holly, too. She can't help it. I was hoping we could start things over again. Oh, fuck, I groan, because I'm having a stroke. I'm dying of shame. I can't do this, Mel. He's the only one not laughing. That was fine, he says, up until the oh, fuck. So forget I said oh, fuck. I won't write oh, fuck. Mel pins his blank, mean little eyes on me. Ray, he says, like he's talking to a kitten. Before, you were painting a picture. You had atmosphere and all that. Now you're just going through the motions. Your heart's not in it, man. You're not painting a picture anymore, and that shit makes me uncomfortable. Excuse the French, Miss Holly. We're going in circles, Holly says. I say we move on. No one's going to move on until Mel gives the say-so. He looks at me. Keep it coming, Ray. I'm done, I say. Better ask the clown. I don't even look at Tom Tom. Mel says something, but his voice is like a butterfly wing moving, and I can't hear. Holly takes a step toward the desk, which is where she keeps the pendant with the emergency switch they all wear around their necks. Holly takes off the pendant as soon as she walks in the room each week. She puts it on the desk, I guess to show us that she trusts us. Now she hesitates. If she pushes that button, class is over, and she hates to lose a class. You can tell everyone is precious to her. Take your seat, Tom, Holly says, because now he's on his feet. Just stretching my legs, Tom-Tom says, and grins his hateful lizard grin at Holly. And I think how small she is in those baggy pants she wears. And right then I see how the point of that outfit is to make her look and feel like a man or even a boy, to hide the female under there so she won't feel weak. By the time Tom-Tom swings around at me, it's too late. Holly's nowhere near the pendant, and Mel's up too, moving fast for a fat guy. I could stop this thing 100 different ways, even now with everyone in motion. It's that way with violence. A slow quiet opens around it, and suddenly there's all this space to move and rearrange things or shut them down. Or maybe that's just how it seems later on, when you wish things had gone a different way. I feel Mel and Tom Tom watching me, waiting for a sign even while they move, but I'm giving them nothing, because I want it. Something inside me is pulling this way. I feel the mystery of it as Mel takes my desk in his hands and flips it upside down, and my head smacks the floor, and I lie there with my eyes shut and those electric sparks flying around against the black. I've made something happen, and it's happening now, and I don't know what it is. She's scared. I can smell it. She kneels down and puts her hand on my head, and I feel her skin, her palm, and thin, warm fingers on my forehead. And attached to those fingers is a body with life pushing out from inside it. Holly Farrell, her hand on my head. It's the weird and terrible way of this place, the little thing, a hand on a head, can matter so much. I wait as long as I can, then I open up my eyes and look at her. She looks back. Soft, worried, bloodshot eyes, pale blue. Enough drama, she says, up. And she goes to meet the COs at the door. Class ends early that day.